All right, it's 8 o'clock. Let's have an AA meeting. Okay, my name is Chris Ward. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. All right. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speaker Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. All right, this reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org desperately in need will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, "Yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing." And our speaker tonight, part of this, you know, thank you, Tim, for asking me to chair. I get to introduce the speaker real quick. I remember when Jacqueline first came in over at the Fifth Tradition Group, and I can't believe how long it's been. Time goes by so fast. She's got a fantastic daughter. She's such fun. And I'm really glad to get to know her, and I'm really looking forward to hearing her story. So with that, I'll give you Jack Lindsay.
Thank you, Chris. I meant to bring my phone up here. Can someone tell me when I'm like halfway? I don't want to say drunk for too long. So my name is Jacqueline. I'm an alcoholic. It is by the absolute grace of God that I'm up here. And I have so many women and some guys from my home group that are here. That are here to support me. And it's amazing because there was absolutely a time in my life where no one wanted to have anything to do with me or support me in any way. My sobriety date is November 3rd, 2011, and my home group is the Fifth Tradition Group, which I am very blessed to be a part of and have such a strong network of women and men in my life. I was born and raised in the suburbs of Chicago. I am the youngest of three girls. I say three because my dad remarried when I was four. So my stepsister is like a sister to me. And my parents obviously divorced when I was very young, so I didn't have any tumultuous divorce thing going on that affected me. And as much as I figured out my fourth step, I tried to blame it on lots of things. It had nothing to contribute to my alcoholism. But my childhood was pretty, it was pretty great, really. I had a really great relationship with my mom. My dad, not so much. He is an alcoholic. But he was a very functioning alcoholic, was able to provide and, go about his business, but just loved to drink his beer, when he got home. And, I would see him on the weekends, and it wasn't until I got a little bit older I realized his struggle with alcohol and some of the things that he kind of put us through as a result of it. It wasn't really until my oldest sister turned 16 and my stepmom expressed how thankful she was that she could drive so my dad didn't have to drive us girls home after dinner out at a restaurant. Him thinking it was appropriate to do donuts in parking lots after dinner, after too many drinks. We thought it was just a fun ride and didn't realize that it really shouldn't have been happening. Growing up, I was involved in, sports and all sorts of stuff and, gymnastics and soccer and, what you name it. My mom, I didn't realize, obviously, until I got older as well, really everything that she did for my sister and I. She, you know, my dad apparently had a habit of other women, and he actually, my stepmom, who he's still married to, was, you know, he cheated my mom with her. And so my mom, you know, was left to raise my sister and I, and she really, you know, she worked hard. She did everything she could to provide for us. I found out later on that, like, my eighth grade trip to Washington, D.C., I was able to go because she called the principal of my school and asked if she could go on a payment plan so that I could go. And those were the kinds of things that she did. But I also saw her struggle a lot, even as I got older, silently struggling. You know, the tears, the, you know, things she didn't want us to see, because she always wanted us to think that she could do anything. And I think, you know, and I know she struggled financially because, and this is a lot to, I think, has turned over in my adulthood, is that the area where I grew up was very affluent. And, you know, I had friends who, in high school, they had their winter car, they had their summer car. I mean, it was a lot to keep up with. And so me, of course, you know, I put a lot of blame on, you know, well, if my parents were still divorced, I wouldn't have this problem. You know, my mom wouldn't be struggling like this if my dad stuck around. And I had a lot of blame for years towards him. But I always felt like I had to keep up with everyone. My mom did everything she could to keep that going. But the one thing she did is that we lived, in Illinois, things are very different with school districts. A county does not comprise a school district in Illinois. There's multiples. So if you went over to another side of the road and you were still in the same county, you'd be in a different school district. And my mom grew up with, or I grew up with people telling my mom, move over to that other side of the street. Literally, it was like the other side of the street. And the expectations of people there were different. The schools weren't as great, but they didn't have as much money, so she wouldn't be competing as much. But the schools were amazing where we lived, and my mom refused to do that. So so it was keeping up with all of this, all of the money and whatnot, and me feeling inadequate and that everyone was looking at me and, you know, saying, oh, she's different. So I think as I grew up, you know, a lot of the choices that I made were to kind of be a part of what everyone was doing. So a lot of my insecurities stemmed pretty early on. And my first drink was when I think it was in like eighth grade. And I was a latchkey kid, for those of you who are old enough to know what that is. So I was the only kid out of my family, or out of my friends, you know, none of their parents, the moms didn't work. Me, I came home to an empty house. So it was about eight of my friends, and we found a good old Miller Lite in the back of the fridge, and we all shared it. And I would love to say it was some amazing experience and that it rocked my world, but it didn't. But it was something that, because I was always a rule follower, and I still am to this day, so it's kind of funny that I hit quite a hiccup along the way, but it was something different and cool to do, and that's kind of how my drinking career went. You know, in high school, it was just partying on the weekends. I still, you know, I got good grades and I did my activities and sports, but it started making a turn around my junior year of high school where I started having more of a social life. I started seeing It was just more fun to hang out with friends than it was to have the responsibilities of having my homework done by a certain time and going to practice and then coming home and blah, blah, blah. And so a lot of my weekends were, you know, well, really, it was usually Wednesdays that my friends and I all carpooled, and after school got out, we drove to downtown Chicago to this one liquor store that we knew by chance sold to us without carding us, and we'd stock up for like a week, and we'd be the suppliers of the beer for all the parties for the weekend. And we'd be gone for like 4 hours because traffic was ridiculous. But we'd bring it back and we'd party on the weekends. But at this point, what I really liked about the drinking was that it left me a little bit more uninhibited. So where I grew up kind of blocking myself off and not really wanting to show who I really was because I was so insecure about it, that this put all my defenses down. And I became this super chatterbox. And remember my friend told me that she called me Chatty Cathy because I guess that was a doll way back in the day. And that was me. I mean, I could just put myself out there. And that was pretty much what drinking did for me for a long time. And then college came around, and that's when it pretty much stayed that way. I went to frat parties, and you know, I went to class, but I always wanted to be doing something where the drinking was. I always wanted to be where things were happening. And so I got a job as a bartender. And I made money and got drunk at the same time. It was fantastic. And I managed to get through college and graduated in 4 years. And still at that point, my alcoholism just hadn't kicked in full force. But things started happening that I had a really hard time with. And really what it was just reality. I was about to graduate, and I just didn't know what I was going to do. I graduated with a Spanish degree. What the hell am I going to do with that? Turns out a lot. But at the time, you know, I was scared. I was terrified. I saw all of my friends going on. They had been in serious relationships. They were going towards getting married. They had been in, you know, lining up careers and all this and that. And I was just kind of lost. I was like, oh my gosh, I've got to grow up. So clearly the only choice was to follow my boyfriend at the time, who was at a different school, to go get a second bachelor degree. Because, you know, going to college again would surely, answers would pop up and make things easier. And that's really where everything really started to go downhill, and that's where the consequences started happening. One of them was we had gone out to the bars. I had had quite a few glasses of wine at dinner, then some Long Island iced teas at the bar along with some shots, and then we were waiting for a cab afterwards, and I had to go to the bathroom, and we... cab was not coming, and I decided to pop a squat in between the Catholic Social Service and their van. And I went, and I went to the bathroom, and I was pulling my pants up, and I was not very steady on my feet. I fell face forward. I broke my nose and had 80 stitches in my face. And they called in a plastic surgeon, wouldn't give me anything for the pain because they knew I'd been drinking. And so thankfully, you know, it didn't leave too much of a mark in many ways. And 3 days later, probably 2 days later, I was out at the bar, my face just... because I didn't want to miss a thing. I needed to be out there and stuff. And people are like, are you all right? I'm like, yeah, I'm great. Like, I mean, I saw nothing wrong with it. And then I was student teaching to be a high school Spanish teacher. And I missed 2 days, no call, no show, because I couldn't get up for my alarm clock. So I came in the next day, and my cooperating teacher handed, you know, asked for the keys back to the classroom and sent me on my way. And that was, I remember trying to make that phone call to my parents, you know. And it kept going. Just stuff like that, that I used to say, how am I ever going to tell anyone this, too? They expect it now. You know, my expectations of, or in my fears of that, just kind of, I just didn't care as much because I just didn't see things getting better. And then Let me see. Train of thought. Oh, and then once I was kicked out of student teaching, I went on to get a master's degree and decided to live in the city of Chicago to go to grad school there and then work at a restaurant during the day. And I was there for about a year. And during that year, I got a DUI. And in my DUI, I flipped my car. And if you know Chicago streets, I showed Sarah the actual street that it happened on when we were in Chicago last weekend. It's not a wide street. And I flipped it and totaled my car. The only thing I really remember is climbing out of the driver's side window. And I refused to take a breathalyzer, but because it was an accident, they took me to the hospital and they drew blood to get my blood alcohol level, and it was 0.42. And that still wasn't enough consequence. The police officer forgot to sign the paperwork, so I never lost my license. My brother-in-law is a criminal attorney in the city of Chicago, and so I got off with a $500 fine, and it was my first offenders. And that was it. At this point, it was just a mess. And I had gotten teaching positions and, you know, never getting contracts renewed, and I couldn't figure out why. Well, you know, I was like, I never drank before I went to work or during work, but by the end of the day, I was DTing so bad that all I could do, I remember, I would get home and I'd have to stop on the way and I'd have to get some hard liquor to cut off those nerves immediately. And then I'd just get some beer so I could kind of get back to my normal feeling. And I would sit there, I'd get home and I'd shake so bad opening that bottle. I'm gonna cry. It was so bad. And I hated myself because I never thought I would be that person. And even through all of that, I decided that moving here would be the answer. And thank God I moved here because all of the events that led up to what happened got me sober. And really once I moved here, I met a guy after I'd been here for about a year. And I was teaching again, and it was the summer, and I met him, and it was, you know, party. And I didn't think much of the relationship. And then I got pregnant. And he cheated on me multiple times. Eventually had the baby. He showed up probably high, and probably quite drunk to the hospital because I had my baby 5 weeks early because my blood pressure was just through the roof and they couldn't get it down. And so he shows up and here I am thinking, well, here's my chance at having a family. You know, I don't know. I mean, I was lonely. I wasn't working at the time because my current job had... It was a private school, and they were basically like, we can't afford to pay you and someone to cover a semester and bring you back. So I was lost. So we got back together, and throughout the time that we were together, he had cheated. He had been abusive. He'd been physically abusive. He had been financially abusive. I would wake up in the morning and see all these charges on my bank account, mostly for freaking, what is that, Xbox 360? Like, really? Like, that's what you're going to steal money over? But I kept taking him back because my self-worth was so low. And I just didn't have anyone else. Until my daughter was 14 months, and we're living in this house in Marietta, and oh good, I'm about to get sober. So I was drinking, but at this point he had once again left, and I hadn't seen him for a couple weeks, and he'd let his friend and his friend's girlfriend move into one of the bedrooms that we had in the house. It was a three-bedroom house, and there was our bedroom, and my daughter's crib was in there, and so her and I were just kind of tucked away in that bedroom, and all the animals, dogs and cats, were out in the main area, and then this couple lived there who were always just kind of drinking and getting high, and then there was the guy who was in the last bedroom, who was literally, he was a drug mule, where he would come in with about 20 grand worth of weed. He'd bring it up into Tennessee, come back with a lot of money, and that's the environment I was living in. And of course, at this time, the world was against me. I was an absolute victim, because how could someone like me end up like this? And One day I put my daughter down for a nap, and at this point, I mean, I was renting at the end since he had left. I didn't have a job. I had nothing. I would scrape up money here and there, and I would buy really cheap bottles of vodka because it would do damage quick. And I put her down for a nap, and I drank a bunch of vodka, and the next thing I know is I wake up to Cobb County Police in my bedroom. And they're trying to ask me questions. I'm trying to figure out what's going on. And thankfully, my ex's parents, his dad is an attorney, and they saw things heading downhill fast, and they had me sign a thing saying that if anything should happen to him or me, that they would take temporary custody of my daughter. And that's exactly what happened. Because I got arrested on felony charges of cruelty to children in the first degree. And I went to jail. And I went to jail for almost a month. I really don't even know, honestly, when I got out. But I remember that my mom bailed me out. And because no one would. I mean, everyone thought, well, if you're in jail, you can't drink. You can't hurt anyone, and your daughter's safe, so we'll just keep you there. So I'd finally gotten my mom to bail me out, and she told me, she said, and it was only $1,000 at this time, and I don't even know if she had to pay the full $1,000, but she was very clear that if she didn't get any money back, she would never speak to me again. That meant I couldn't do a damn thing until I was off probation, and I was clear. So I got out of jail, and that night I had nowhere to go. I was lucky enough to find my purse with my keys in the house where I was living. And I had my car, and I went to the bar because what else was I going to do? And the next morning I called a friend of mine who had rescued me, when I was pregnant with my daughter, and my ex had cheated on me, and she let me stay with her until I had the baby. I called her again, and she let me come live with her. And I was there about 2 weeks, and I did everything I could to keep my head above water, applying for jobs, doing everything I could, trying to figure out how I was going to eat. And I just got tired. I got so tired. I just couldn't do it. And my ex's mother sent me an email about a program for women with children through MAR called Right Side Up. And I went into Right Side Up, and I spent 8 months there. And during that time, I never really prayed before. I always had foxhole prayers, and I went to church as a kid. But I prayed for anything. I prayed, I said, God, just help me. Just anything, something. I don't know what I'm asking for, but something. And I remember I would wake up in the morning, and I would be so excited for like 10 o'clock because that's when lights were out, and I knew I had to go to bed, and I had to make it to the next day because the next day something different was going to happen. And it was another vase over. And it was just another step towards something. I don't know. But then Mickey got a job, and I tried getting into child care with that felony arrest. And actually, I went to this daycare where I was interviewed, and this guy hired me right away. He's like, "What? I don't know why you're here. You have a master's degree in education, and you're at my daycare." And then he hired me, and then I told my counselor. She's like, "Yeah, you're going to need to tell him about your background." And I was like, "Fine." It's like my first experience with just being honest and putting something out there. Man, God works fast. Because I called him up, and he goes, "I know, I ran your background check already." And he goes, he's like, "I want you to come in, and we'll talk." And he said, "I can't put you in a classroom with kids, but I can put you at our front desk." He's like, "I'm going to tell you something." He's like, I'm a deacon at a church. He's like, "And I believe two things." He says, "I believe that bad things happen to good people, and I believe in second chances." And so he hired me, and I worked there for almost 2 years. Once I got out of the program, I, my idiot self, got back together with my daughter's father. Oh my God. but I tried to make that work. But in the meantime, you know, God offered many blessings along the way. And one of those was the state came into that job and they said, "We need to see everyone's background check." And they got to mine and they said, "Well, you're going to have her fingerprinted and supply some extra papers, and she can't come see in the school until then." And during this time, you know, I still have bills to pay, and so my boss was kind enough to let me go in on the weekends and just organize things, and so he could still pay me. And through letters that people wrote on my behalf, I was granted a satisfactory background check, a federal one. Now, I wasn't convicted of a felony. I have a misdemeanor for something different. So I think, you know, obviously that had a lot to do with it. But I never would have used that as my catalyst for the next steps that I've taken in my life. You know, I've never been able to put something out there and just let it see what happens. So things were okay with work and stuff, and but obviously my relationship had as my sobriety maintained. See, I was so grateful that Right Side Up took these women to the Fifth Tradition Group. Because every Thursday night, I would go, we'd go to so many meetings, and we'd go to all these different meetings, and I heard so much of, my life is just so horrible, and how am I going to get through the next day? And then I would go to the Fifth Tradition Group, and there were all these people who were happy, and all they talked about at the meeting was, "This is what I did to get sober, and this is what I do on a daily basis to stay focused and to maintain my sobriety." And I was like, "Oh my gosh, like they're happy? What?" So when I got out of Right Side Up, I went to a meeting and I identified with one of the women who would speak often, and I said, "Hey, you know, can you be my sponsor?" And she said, "Yeah," and she's been my sponsor ever since. And along the way, she had told me, because my ex was continuing to drink because he has a problem. and so she had told me, she said, "You know, if you stay in this relationship, you're going to drink." And I, you know, I didn't believe it. I dragged my feet for a long time. And in a lot of aspects of getting involved with the group. And I would listen to what she had to say, but I never actually acted on it. And it got to the point where I started talking to more women. I started calling more women. And there's a few one in particular here tonight who was very vital in me getting out of that relationship. Because he would verbally abuse me so bad. He would pull me out of bed 2 a.m, trashed. And he would make me stand outside with him while he smoked, while I'm praying that my daughter doesn't wake up. Man, he said the worst things. He made me feel about that big. And like I didn't deserve anything. That I was on my high horse because I was sober and I thought I was better than him and I was working and he was miserable. And it took a lot of people and a lot of help to make me realize that that's not who I am. But there was one person I could call any time of the night, and I could drive over there and I would sleep there just to get away. And there came a point where there was one night he came in the bedroom and he knew I didn't want him smoking in the house. I had quit and I didn't want my daughter around it. And he would just lay in bed next to me and he'd just light the cigarette. And he'd just smoke right there and just blow it in my face. And he was just so drunk. And he got up and we had a baby gate at the door because I never wanted her coming out in the middle of the night to see what he was doing. And he tripped at the baby gate and he fell down. And she woke up and she's like, "Mommy, what's wrong with Daddy?" And at that moment, that's when I called my sponsor and I said, "I'm ready. I'm ready to move on." So for about a month, I had planned to leave, but I couldn't leave until a certain date because she was offering me part of her house. And so I'd little by little gotten some of my things and put them in my car. And I turned him over to her place. He had no idea. He was so clueless. And on a Friday night, about 4 weeks later, I sat him down and I said, "Hey, we need to talk." And he got like a scared look in his face. And he said, he's like, "All right, what's up?" And I said, "I'm leaving. I can't do this anymore." And he's like, "When?" I said, "Tomorrow." Because through conversations with my sponsor, we realized it probably wasn't the safest thing for me to let him know weeks ahead of time that this was happening. So I lived for 3 months in my sponsor's basement, which is a nice basement. It's, you know, there's a bathroom and a kitchen and a bedroom, so... And my daughter and I, you know, we just made it work. I didn't sleep a lot. I didn't eat a lot. Some of you remember I was really disgustingly skinny because my nerves were all over the place. But I saved money and I moved close to where I work. Oh, which now I'm actually the director of a private preschool. So I actually run a school now. But not only that, but once I finally got some semblance of what my life looked like, and I allowed so much more in. I started sponsoring women. I learned who I am. I started doing the things that I used to love to do. You know, I read books. Not as many as some people, but it's my turn. I go and I hang out with my friends, and I do all these awesome things. I go to weddings, and I don't drink, and I don't want to. And I'm a useful member of where I go to my meetings. I never thought in a million years I would have this much fun. And my daughter's awesome. She's a little diva, a little exhausting sometimes. I can only imagine what she's trying to convince the babysitter that's okay this evening. You know, she's now at a place where she's never remembered me drinking, ever. You know, when I walked in these doors, I just wanted to stop drinking so I could get her back. so maybe I could get a job and eat. I never wanted to stay sober. Because you people were crazy. I mean, I was so sick. I used to think that when people, I watched a lot of daytime TV, and I used to think that when people were on like Regis and Kelly, that there's no way that they were sober, and that what they had in their little mug was not coffee, it was not water, it was just pure vodka, because there's no way they were going to be able to do that. That's like literally, I like convinced myself, it's so sick. And you know, life is not easy, and I have gone through so much more stuff being sober than I ever had when I was drinking, and that's because I am living life. I am present. I am putting myself out there. I leave myself vulnerable, and that allows for hurt, pain, joy, success, all of it. But that's what you do. And I've got a huge group of people I can go to and talk to. And what's awesome is that I have since been in a relationship that has ended. But the great thing I learned about it is that I can be loved and I deserve to be treated well. And that I'm capable of receiving that and giving that. And I'm super nervous because I have decided to put myself out there and apply for jobs in the school districts. And I was offered a position. And as of today, tomorrow morning, the HR director is reviewing my disposition from court and my personal statement. So I put that out there, and there's nothing more I can do about it. Because I've at least, up until this point, I have led my life the way that I feel I can best lead it as honestly and as genuinely as possible. So regardless of what happens, I know that God's got a plan for whatever it's going to be, and everything is going to be okay. That's all I've got.
Thank you, Jacqueline. She did the most important thing when you're telling your story. Finish on time. We'll be right back.
circumstances.